Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, and thanks, Tim, for working this out. Shall I try and stand to speak into this? Does it make much difference if I walk? I should try and stick. I can't walk around. That's what you're trying to say. Okay, I'll shout. That's brilliant. Okay, well, let me give a few just intro comments to this stuff. We appreciate that this is an area of life which is potentially an area of real fruitfulness and usefulness for God's purpose and God's glory, in terms of our corporate life as a church, but also in terms of your individual callings. But it's sometimes an area that's under-emphasized for various reasons, which we'll perhaps go into on another occasion. And therefore, people can be under-equipped because they're not really taught in ways that are helpful with biblical concepts to train their thinking about issues of creativity. And so we're trying to rectify that a bit by saying, look, let's deliberately gather people with particular gifting in creative areas, artistic areas, or perhaps even people who that's the area of work that they're involved with, that's where they thrive, that's where they even earn their money, so that we can actually helpfully give people a strong sense of ability, equipping, strength to carry on with their calling in a way that's kind of kingdom-oriented. But also we know that in a church like ours, there's a great opportunity for real networking, real friendship, fellowship to emerge when you gather people with similar gifts and skills and passions. Most of you in this room will not know everybody here. In fact, some of you will only know literally two or three people here. We want to do our best to provide opportunities for you to network with those who are skilled in and passionate for the area of the arts and for creative things in general, so that there can be partnerships, ways of going forward that can really be mutually helpful for brothers and sisters across the church. So we're trying to provide an environment, as this thing here says on the front cover, for fellowship, support, instruction and networking, and to equip saints with a biblical worldview and thus aid their creativity. It says here, to understand the development of a culture, its influences past and present, and to focus on our role in engaging and transforming our culture for Jesus. It's worth saying that ultimately the way we will transform our culture for Jesus will not really be through events that we put on, things that we do as a church. So this is CCK doing creative things. We don't rule that kind of concept out. We'd still want to occasionally do such things, and we want to make sure that we do what we do in a way that is artistically and aesthetically credible, right down to things like how we present our building, right down to the way we use our website, the way we play music. It won't be to everybody's taste, but since these things are not chosen democratically but basically based on what I want, it doesn't really matter. We know that there'll be various kind of interpretations of the style, but nevertheless what we're aiming at is saying that in this city we want to present ourselves as a local church in a way that does engage people aesthetically. But our hope really is in believers as they spread out, representing the church, being the church, spread out into their various roles in society, whether it's in their job or whatever sphere of life they find themselves in, serving Jesus, worshipping Jesus with their skill. That actually is going to be ultimately far more impacting, far more effective. It will have far more ultimate effect, because what you're doing then is putting the yeast right into the dough, letting it spread itself. Even if it feels like it's spreading itself very thinly, the whole point of yeast is that it takes a little while, but eventually you see its effect. My experience of cooking, from when I used to try and cook pizzas, was I'd try and make... I do cook quite a lot, actually, but I don't do pizzas anymore. But my experience was that I would put in the amount of baking powder that the ingredients said I was supposed to put in to make the dough, but I would instinctively put in more, because my intuition told me that's just not enough baking powder. That's never enough baking powder to make this thing rise. It's not going to rise. I'm not impressed with that amount of baking powder. And I knew better than the ingredients. I knew better than what it said in the book, because I was always right. So I put in more baking powder, and eventually I'd have this... What I'd have is like cheese and tomato puree sticking to the top of the oven on the inside, you know, because it would just all the way up. And I try and put... I couldn't even pull it out. I had to get a clamp, you know, to try and... And I got this reputation with all the students I live with for making these ridiculous pizzas. And I think I've learned my lesson. It will never happen again. And the next time I make a pizza, I'll put in a bit less. I'll just put in what it says in the book. But I'd say... That's still not enough, you know. And I just—it's this gut feeling when it comes to yeast that we just think that's not enough. It's not going to make a difference. But that's presumably why Jesus, well, why Scripture talks about yeast in dough in those terms. That actually it gives you give the impression that it's not big. It's not going to make a big deal. But actually, the more confident we are in the gospel, the more fruit, more committed we are, more we hold the line of the gospel, the more actually we're functioning as yeast, even in small ways that can have huge ramifications as time goes on. Anyway, that's a little illustration that I wasn't even going to make, but it seems appropriate. I'm trying to just sort of outline, really, some of the rationale for why we're doing this. You might think, well, we're coming here to plan an event, to plan a series of events. Some of you might rejoice to hear, and some of you might be saddened to hear that that is not the case. We're not here to plan a great arty event that CCK are doing. We may do those things, but that's not what this is primarily for. We're really here to try and serve you in your calling and to just help us as a church to serve one another as best as we can. Let me just go through a few things. I hope you like this booklet. It's got the wrong title. CCK Creatives Morning is actually not the title that we've gone with. We've gone with Arts Network, which is a much better title. It's also not got a picture on the front cover. I thought I'd leave that space for you. If you feel like you want to just fill that in, I thought I'm not going to put in a picture. I'll let you get carried away, doodle while I'm talking. If you get bored, we can perhaps do a little contest at the end to see who comes up with the best one. Drawing of something, certainly not a drawing of me, please. That would be grateful for that. I wondered about, should we give you folders so you can keep all these things that we'll bring every time, you know, leaflets that you put in folders. And I thought, get real. You're bringing this to a group of arty creative types. Do not bring them folders. They'll be like, no, this is evil. Folders, no. That's the man. We don't want the man. Don't want plastic folders. So we're not having folders, we're just having these notes here, which I do hope you'll go through with me, even if it feels a bit linear. I hope you'll still follow these notes with me, because they are supposed to be useful. I wanted to recommend one or two books as well. I will just shove them up. Okay, for the tape or the download or whatever it is, a couple of books here I wanted to mention. I'll try and mention a few books over the next few times we do this, but I'll just mention these two to start you off with. Here's a book called Art and Soul. It's published by IVP. It's written by Hilary Brand and Adrienne Chaplin, and it's just I think it's a very helpful kind of staple text on the relationship between the gospel and art. Covering a huge amount of ground fairly comprehensively and very, in, I think, a quite a balanced way. You won't agree with everything it says. I don't agree with everything it says, but I find, you know, the gist of it very helpful. And they make some brilliant points. Very winsomely written. It's very easy to read, good to get into. And whatever your area where you're gifted, where you serve, as it were, this will be practically relevant, I trust. Another book, which is a little bit more dense and tightly argued and slightly out of date, I have to confess, is a book called Modern Art and the Death of a Culture by a Dutchman called Hans Rukmacher. So his surname is spelled Rukmacher. And that's published also by IVP. I don't know if it's in print anymore. I hope it is. It's called Modern Art and the Death of a Culture. If you can get hold of a second-hand copy, not mine, You would be very, very wise to purchase it and read it. It's quite intense. It's a sharp and dense argument, which actually I'll be going through much of the point that he's making in the book in the talk that I'm doing now. But obviously he'll do it more comprehensively in the book. So it's a very helpful book on how art has developed to be the way it is, especially in our Western context, and how a biblical worldview needs to engage with the kind of ideas that have influenced the way art is shaped in our present time. So those are two good books. I'll recommend others perhaps as time goes on other occasions. But let me just get into this material. I want to talk today about the subject of worldview. And it might seem a little bit of a strange step to take, a bit like walking away from the high jump pole before you go to run over it. But you know, you do that in athletics because you're wanting to make a better jump. You know, you don't just sprint up towards it and just leap. You calculate, you think about the goal, you walk away from it first and run up carefully. And I think what I want to do in this session is try to almost walk away from directly addressing the theme of art and look more at the issue of worldview behind art. So that as believers, we are as equipped as we can be in the time that we have today, to look objectively at our culture and think, what are some of the ideas that are behind the culture? What are some of the ideas that are behind acts of creativity that are pressed in all around us, that we face all around us all the time, and kind of understand them well, and because we understand them well, know how to act. The Book of Chronicles talks about the sons of Manasseh who understood the times and knew what they were to do, which is a very helpful verse. People who understand the times are equipped to serve God in them. It's possible to make mistakes, not because we don't understand God's word necessarily or because we don't understand God's ways, but more because we just don't understand the time in which we find ourselves. And good ministry on whatever level, whether it's preaching on a platform or painting a fresco or whatever, is best done by those who have the ability to discern God's truth and discern the culture and know how the two should engage and how to most fruitfully shape the culture through God's truth. So looking at the culture, looking at what actually are some of the ideas that have shaped us, will hopefully be a fruitful thing. I'm going to race through these notes as fast as I can, but we'll almost certainly not cover them. So by all means, read them in your own time and perhaps come back to me with questions on other occasions. But let's look first, what do I mean by worldview? The centrality of our worldview. A worldview is really a kind of it's like a word that basically means lenses. It's like, I mean, I'm wearing these lenses that actually totally change the way I see the world, thankfully for the better. They are the lenses through which I understand my surroundings. And everybody has a set of lenses through which they understand the data, the information that's pushed in at them all the time. They may not be conscious of that. They may think, well, I don't have a worldview. I just believe what I see. But that, even in saying that, you are betraying a worldview. There's always an interpretation that we place upon the information that comes to us, that we place upon the culture that we see and observe. George Barna puts it like this from a Christian point of view. I find this a helpful quotation. He says, without a biblical worldview, all the great teaching goes in one ear and out the other. There are no intellectual pegs in the mind of the individual to hang these truths on. So they just pass through. They don't stick. They don't make a difference. That's sadly very often the case, it seems. Believers can sit in church for years and hear sermon after sermon after sermon after sermon, but never consider the fact that there is a whole central body of truth. In effect, there is really one sermon. There is ultimately one sermon, one revelation of God that is coherent. It all fits together. It's true truth. It's not that one thing is true one week and the following week, because the preacher said it really powerfully, that's true. And it's the opposite of what the preacher the week before said, which was kind of said a bit less powerfully, so it can't be as true. Now, I'm being a bit crass, but that's not far from how sometimes we as believers can respond to things. I've sometimes seen trainees go off on Impact or FP, you know, the equivalent of things where they go off on a year of training or perhaps a season of training on theological training. And I've asked them, how did it go? What did you learn? And occasionally I find it interesting the kind of comments can be rather superficial. You know, they're not always, but sometimes you feel that you're hearing a kind of a subjective response to it, to impressions made by certain speakers. They're not necessarily trying to imbibe truth into a system of truth that actually holds together. It's more just the occasion itself sets a spark off that seems memorable. So how was the training? Well, so-and-so spoke, and he was really good. What did he say? I don't know, but it was really good. It was really good. And, I mean, you know, to put it to its... one occasion, I remember someone saying... I remember a preacher... when we were at he used this illustration. It was so powerful, so powerful. He took a hammer to a mirror, smashed the mirror in front of us. It was such a powerful illustration. And I said, what is he trying to illustrate? And the person said, I don't know, actually, but it was so powerful. And some of you people right now are thinking, yeah, but that's what art is, isn't it? And no, it ain't. Anyway, no, it can be. But the point I'm making is that truth has to fit together as God's revelation, and it's possible to not even see it as our responsibility to assemble a biblical worldview. You can actually sit under teaching for years but never ever form a worldview because you're thinking of just the moment, that information of the moment. And like Alice in Wonderland, you can believe 10 or 12 contradictory things before breakfast. You know, several things you can believe that actually don't even fit together, but I just believe them. Well, that's something not quite right about that. There's a need for us to develop a holistic and comprehensive worldview that fits together. So, what is a worldview? What does it matter? How do our worldviews affect us? This is a quotation from James Sire, which is very helpful. A worldview is a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, which we hold, consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic makeup of the world. So, even if you don't think you've got one, you've got one. A worldview is a grid through which we interpret existence. We all have a worldview. All our philosophers, all our theologians, all have an intellectual infrastructure upon which we base our life values and ideas, even if this is not consciously constructed. Presuppositions which answer the key questions are the following. So this is taken from James Sire's book, which is quite helpful. These are the questions. If you want to know what someone's worldview is, it's most obviously seen through the way they would naturally answer these seven questions. What is prime reality, the really real? How do you know what is real as opposed to what isn't? How do you distinguish? What is the nature of external reality, that is, the world around us? What is a human being? What happens to a person at death? Why is it possible to know anything at all? How do we know what is right and wrong? What is the meaning of human history? So what I want to do with the rest of this is to try and investigate the development and effect of the principal worldviews that influence our kind of contemporary Western culture. This is a bit Western oriented, but for most of us, I think that's the most relevant and immediately relevant, directly relevant. And then respond from a biblically informed worldview as time goes on, which we'll do more of in subsequent days. So today I'm looking more at what's out there. You know, on another day we'll look more at what's, if I had my Bible here, I'd say what's in there. I don't have my Bible, but trust me, I still believe it. So let's look at historical development of the modern and then postmodern thought. Don't be scared, by the way, of some phrases. You'll see some words in here that will be long words, and they are mainly put there to make me look clever. Okay, so that's the main reason. If you don't understand them, that's not a problem, because it still makes me look clever, and that's the main goal. Someone always says, this is a bit of a disclaimer that I'll just get out of the way. Someone always says, haven't these ideas always been around? So things like modernism and postmodernism, which I'll explain in a second. Some will say, well, these ideas have always been around. There's nothing new about them. There's nothing new under the sun. It says in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. There's nothing. It's just old ideas rehashed. I would say yes and no. I would say there's wrong worldviews are just idols and sin. And let's not blame all our failings on, a philosopher, a postmodern philosopher. which is a tempting thing. It's nice to say, well, all our problems are because we've drunk the milk of bad philosophers. That's why the world is in the mess it's in. No, the world's in the mess it's in because a man and a woman ate some fruit they shouldn't have. It goes back a lot further than some postmodern philosophers. Nevertheless, what certain philosophers say certainly affects the way culture operates. And all culture is influenced by intellectual developments, whether we like it or not. And when I say culture, I really mean all culture. Okay, culture, you could think of, I'm using the term culture to mean high culture, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to EastEnders and Heat magazine. I'm actually not. I mean culture in its broadest sense. All of culture, including Heat magazine, including Big Brother, including Strictly, are affected in some way, usually without meaning to be, by philosophical ideas that affect trends, that affect other trends, that affect other trends, and they give birth to multiple generations of grandchildren, you know, intellectually speaking, that affect our lives all over the place. So it's no good just pushing these things aside. Francis Schaeffer used to talk about the a sort of staircase of culture. And he'd talk about the staircase, which would begin up here with those who write philosophy, often in university departments. And then it kind of, each step of the staircase was another area of culture that fed off the one above it. So philosophy affects the arts, affects theatre, affects music, and so on. I'm just, he put it more clearly exactly how each one would come after another. But what you end up with is the bottom step, which is just popular culture, you know, TV, websites, whatever. But somehow they've all taken from upstream. They've all drunk from what's up here, sometimes knowingly, sometimes without knowing. But nevertheless, the influence is there. And sometimes people will respond even to these questions. Shouldn't we be concentrating just on getting people saved? Why does it matter how the culture is affected by the gospel? Why shouldn't we just be focusing on getting individuals rescued from the culture, rescued from hell? And there's so many, I mean, it's obviously a very good question, very understandable, very important question. It needs to be poked at all these issues so that we don't escape into some bubble. But I would actually respond, one of the ways I'd respond to that is by saying, how saved do you want people to be? Our concept of salvation mustn't be reduced to just being rescued from a sinking ship onto a lifeboat called the gospel, while the universe perishes and individuals are rescued away from it. If that's our concept, then actually we've somewhat limited what the gospel really is. The salvation that the Bible preaches is broader than that. It's about the transforming, the healing, the restoring of all things, which obviously includes primarily the restoring of human relationships to God. But actually, Colossians 1, for example, just the top of my head, deliberately doesn't leave it there, but talks about all things, visible and invisible, all creation being restored, reconciled back to God through Christ. As long as that is the mandate, as long as that is God's plan to reconcile all things under the headship of Christ, we've got no business limiting the gospel just to ticking names off and saying, well, saved, not saved. We mustn't reduce it. Now, hear me right, that's still primary. It's still of great importance, if not of first importance. It's the thing that we most rejoice in, repentance of sinners, those coming to... Now, obviously, you know, we could go on and on about that. You know me, that's what we live for. But nevertheless, the gospel is holistic in its impact. Salvation is a broad term. If we understand the Bible's story as it unpacks itself, as we look at the Bible as a big story, God's plan, as you read it from Genesis to Revelation, you read the prophets and read what they're saying about what God intends to do for the nations, you realize it must be more than rescue individuals away from a burning ship. It's got to be broader than that. There's got to be a transforming of the cosmos that is affected through the gospel. And so that's one important thing to bear in mind. It obviously affects the way we consider the arts especially. Let me make another disclaimer and say these comments I'm making, which I'm running out of time to make, are very broad brushstrokes. Okay? I'm going to say things that if a scholarly historian was in the room, he would kill me. So I'm not going to pretend that this is careful, fine brush stuff. I'm going to talk about this in very broad terms. You understand that, you know, being arty, not using the fine paintbrush, whatever that is. What's a fine paintbrush? Do you know anything about? I don't know anything about this. Yeah, I'm going to use like a roller. That's what I'm doing here. Roller stuff. All right, Rolf Harris. That's what I am today. Okay, Rolf Harris. This is the first part is looking at what we would call modernism. Okay, let me just take you through how modernism has happened. The reason I do this, let me just reiterate, is because we need to understand our culture. The way to understand the world we're in is to understand how it got here. You know that there's a guy called Arthur Marwick who talked about history as the solution to social amnesia. Amnesia affects one person, is devastating. Imagine a whole society which is cursed with it. A whole society is instantly sliced off from its past. Don't know anything about it. That's hugely dangerous. And the reality is that is how most people do live. We still live detached from the past. But actually the best way to understand the present is to go looking as to how it came that way. You know, films like The Bourne Identity, where you get this concept of the guy that has no idea of his history, doesn't understand himself because he doesn't understand his past. He can't actually live until he understands his past. He can't really be truly a human being without some grasp of his background, how he came to be the way. And that's very true. I think that's the way God's made us. And even on a social level, I believe that's the way God's made us. So I'm trying to just do a bit of a treatment of how we've come the way we have. Going back to around the time of 1500 then, and again, don't be frightened of big words. Don't be frightened of dates. I'm not trying to intimidate. I promise you. I'm just trying to give us a general picture. There's a season where we would say that the theistic worldview, which basically is a lens which assumes that the God of the Bible is there and he's created things and he is working redemptively through his son to restore things, and that he's communicated himself to us through his son, and the testimony of his son is understood through the writings of scripture, and those people that hold the writings of scripture have responsibility to teach about this God and his son. That's a very broad definition of a Christian worldview, which would be true of Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant Christianity, which in the time I'm talking about, which is before the Reformation, that would have been the existing worldview. If you went up to just about anybody in Europe in the year 1500 and started to talk to them about their soul or about their relationship to God or what Christ meant to them, they wouldn't have any difficulty engaging you. They would totally understand what you're talking about. And there would even be perhaps some level of personal faith that would just immediately you'd see in the way they communicated and responded. That would just be prevalent. There was a season in history, a long season, where that was the going worldview of the culture. And that's obviously not the case now. Things have happened to change that. One of the key changes, and actually, just let me just communicate with Mr. Jones. Where are you? I'm going on. How are you feeling? You're feeling good? You're feeling cool? Okay. Okay, if everyone's feeling all right, and no one gets up and screams and runs out, I'm going to just carry on for a little bit, because I want to do as much justice to these notes as I can before we finish. The kind of culture that developed around sort of 1600s was partly in response to what's called the Renaissance. Renaissance literally means rebirth, and it was a time in the early modern period, about 1500s, 1600s, where it was European thinkers and artists and creative people and so on began to go back to the achievements and the values and the learning of the ancient people, particularly the Greeks and the Romans. And it was like what they did was they stretched out across what they saw as the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, the era of superstition and muddle-headedness, and took back off the shelf the ancient traditions of the Romans and Greeks and blew the dust off them and looked at them more carefully and said, this is when we were at our best. This is humanity at its best with these arts and sciences and engineering and these skills that put man in the center of his universe. And so what is now called humanism had its kind of birth in the Renaissance time. And effectively what it was doing was it was kind of saying, right, the assumption that there's this God in the center of everything in whom we live and move and have our being, as Paul puts it in Acts 17, we're going to just not base everything on that assumption. We're going to imagine that that isn't true. We're going to really start with ourselves. We're going to start trying to understand the universe mostly through just our own human experience and put humankind at the center of everything. And I'm rushing very much through time as I make these comments, but the next thing that you can see happening is that these two words here that I'm particularly proud of, Cartesian epistemology, you know, just put them into scale. It doesn't exist, I just made it up. But Cartesian epistemology is named after a Frenchman called René Descartes, who's the famous one that said, I think, therefore I am. You heard that expression, I think, therefore I am. Descartes was basically saying, how can you know things? How can you know anything? You can't know everything. We assume too much to imagine that you can know stuff just because you see it or because the priest says it or the Bible says it. You're basing your whole life on a massive assumption there. What we should do is not assume anything. What we should do is doubt everything. Doubt everything. The key to understanding is to doubt everything. And so I will ask questions about the existence of every single thing to the point where I'll doubt even my own existence. I'll doubt that even I exist. That's what you end up having to do. If you go down the route of saying, how can you really know that? How can you, like kids, you know, how do we know this? How do you know that? How do you know, why is that? Why, you know, they ask the umpteenth question. If you go down that logical route forever and ever, you have to ask questions, how do I even know that I exist? You know, you have those thoughts, you know, what if I'm just in someone's dream? What is this? Is this all real? You know, I remember being a kid growing up thinking, any minute now, everyone's going to turn around and go, surprise! You know, maybe you didn't have that. I had that all the time. That was just the weird way my mind works. But I kind of imagine, I wonder if this is all set up for me. I mean, that may not just be, that may just be complete arrogance. You know, the person, everyone's just revolving around me. I still think that, obviously. But the way that that this works is you're kind of doubting everything and thinking, what is real? What can I truly depend on? And Descartes was saying, what can you know? Well, the conclusion he came to for his own sake was, at least I know this, that I'm doubting. The fact that I'm doubting something shows that something, you know, I can know that I doubt at least that much. And that, so what he, when he said, I think, therefore I am, what he literally meant was, I doubt, therefore I am. I doubt. The only reason I know I exist is because I'm doing this doubting thing. Someone's doing it, and it's me. So that's it. So the basis of truth, a basis of knowing anything and working out all reality and working it out from there, like the first plank, the next plank, became doubting everything, to like pulling the skin off everything, like an onion, peeling it all away until there's practically nothing left. And trying to reassemble the universe according to what he considered much more sort of scientific means of information. And actually Descartes was a mathematician. So the way he did it was he thought, well, I'm going to doubt everything and start again with just maths, because math seems to me, you know, it seems a bit subjective, a decision to make, but it seemed to him that it was the most kind of pure and reliable form of knowledge, mathematical knowledge. 2 + 2 always equals 4. 4 + 4 equals, always equals 8. And these equations, these systems, these kind of systems of understanding the world, they are at least dependable. And so we'll base all our knowledge on scientific reason that's birthed in kind of mathematical logic. Now, I mean, this seems a bit highfalutin, but the point is, Western culture got to the point where it doubted everything, and it replaced confidence in the God of Revelation with confidence in human rationalism. That was what happened. Ultimately, there's this huge swing that happens. It takes about 100 years to take full root. But eventually you get to the point where the way people work out the world and understand philosophy is to basically enshrine and almost worship human reason as the final authority on absolutely everything, including God. Whether he's existing, or whether he's even what he's like, whether it's a he, whatever. Everything is put down to the authority of human reason. We work it out from there. instead of saying, well, look, the assumption we're going to start with is that God is true and he's revealed himself to us in Scripture, we assume actually we don't trust anything. We only assume our own ability to doubt. And the overall effect of that is what you call secular humanism, ultimately. Deism, which means, okay, there must be a God because, well, the whole thing got started somehow. This is before Big Bang Theory and so on had kind of found its way, and Darwinism hadn't touched the world yet at this time. This is long before Darwin. But they knew, well, there must be some beginning to all of this. So they had a deity, but not a person, not a person of you can engage with and know. And relate to, and who speaks to and reveals himself to you. No. Just a cause, a first cause, a watchmaker. You know, there's like the William Paley thing. I found a watch lying on the floor. There must be a watch designer. And it's the same. This universe, it must be a designer. That's the way that people began to construe the God that they believed in. Not from revelation of Scripture. Not from thinking, well, there is a God, and we've sinned against him, and so we can't understand him. Our reason, even our minds are flawed. And we need his mercy and grace to come to us and rescue us from our foolish hearts, which suppress the truth, as Romans chapter 1 puts it. No, we'll assume that we're on a level playing field. We'll assume that our minds are perfectly balanced and able to understand things if we just put them to it carefully. We've understood how to make the wheel and how to make, you know, ultimately how to split atoms. We understand how to get God. We get it. We'll start from here. Thank you very much. So human reason is elevated, and you end up with ultimately an environment where you think, well, what's God for in the first place? We don't really need God. We don't. We're doing fine without him anyway. And actually, you can't even understand him in scientific terms. You can't really verify his existence through test tubes and Bunsen burners. So what use is he? Understanding God scientifically doesn't quite exist, really. You don't really understand him. You might make a good theory that he exists. Many have, but it's not. You don't really know him that way. But the kind of God that people were coming back with might as well not be there. So you end up with what then is called scientism, where you trust ultimately in scientific rational theory rather than in God. It's not that that's not just having science. That's trusting and worshipping in science. Empiricism, rationalism, these are all big words that kind of mean similar concepts. But you get the general picture here from the basic trend that people have put the revelation of God aside, replacing revelation with reason. That's the main point. Revelation is pushed off the throne. Reason becomes the new God, the new authority, the final arbiter and judge over everything. Tom Wright, the theologian, puts it like this. The Enlightenment, which is the period of time I'm talking about now, post-Renaissance, kind of 16th, 17th, 18th century, established a rival eschatology to the New Testament. What I mean by that is, in the New Testament, the time when man came into fulfillment was when Jesus rose from the dead. In the New Testament, that marks the change in history. The changing moment in history is when Jesus died upon the cross and rose from the dead. That is the great epoch-shaping moment in time. In this worldview I'm giving to you now, the great change that happened was when people started to put the Bible aside and started to trust in human reason. A rival eschatology, a replacement eschatology, saying the story of history is about man becoming wiser according to his own reason and really becoming less and less dependent on the God that we used to take so seriously. You have the American Revolution, which is influenced to some degree by this kind of thinking, and you have Romanticism, which we can talk about another time. Romanticism is a different concept. It's a reaction to rationalism because people are so wired by God that they can't really handle a purely rational existence. They can't handle the idea that basically we're just machines. Basically we're just chemicals. That's really what we are. We're just determined by our genes. That's all we really are. The human spirit, as God has made it, as I understand it from Scripture, can't really cope with that. You can't be forced quite into that mold. You still have this passion inside you. This longing to worship, this longing to embrace and enjoy and to have love and life and joy and wonder and a sense of transcendence and numinous and something beyond. That's still there. Even if you're an atheist, you still have to accept that's still there. That longing is still there. And so you get people like the poets, like Byron and Shelley and Keats, and other great sort of artists like Turner and composers like Beethoven, who reacted against the kind of over-the-top rationalism as they saw it of their time, and said, look, man is more than a machine. He's more than a reasonable, logic processor. He's not a calculator. Man is an animal. Man is full of instincts and passions and fire and color and beauty. And so they celebrate it, but kind of in reaction. They can't celebrate it on truth because they're making actually the same assumptions that the rationalists are making. So people like Byron were not any more godly. In fact, they were probably a lot less godly than the rationalists. But they reacted. They knew something. They got something right. They knew the human heart can't exist in the vacuous kind of world of just pure reason. So that's a season that we can come back to another occasion. It's very important how I understand the arts. 1789, though, this is an important symbol of the time. 1789 is the French Revolution. And we won't go into all the detail of this, but there's the emergence of great big stories, meta-narratives, as we call them. Ideas that shape society in a really obvious way. Systems for how to understand history and the world. And what's interesting is that when the French Revolution took place and the Bastille was stormed and we just huge cataclysmic events that changed the history of Europe, what happened was churches were really kind of treated with hostility and the clergy and so on. And in replacement, literally, worship of reason literally took off to the point where they'd have worship services to the God of reason, the God of the mind. And statues were erected in replacement of crucifixes and so on to the goddess of reason as a symbol of saying that this is our new symbol of what we live for as a culture. So you get to see how hugely culture shifted at that important stage and why it is so weird for us in this post-Enlightenment world. Do you know what I mean? It's that we live in a world where we feel that we are on the edge. There was a stage where the gospel had such thriving impact on the whole of culture that, as I say, you would not have felt in the same way the sense of marginalization. You would have felt, actually, the going worldview is a godly one, or at least a Christian-shaped one, even if not everyone was godly, certainly not. But the way that people think has been totally reshaped by the Enlightenment, and ever since. Now, let me just... I'll do this really quick, because I will literally have to do this in a moment. And you'll have to read the notes yourself to get the better idea of what I'm trying to say. What you get in this season that you and I live in is kind of a mixture, where you have the effect of a culture that's drifted away from God deliberately, but also a culture that has drifted away from the things that it drifted away from God on, if you know what I mean. It's like I'm trying to illustrate something of what I'm talking. Like a huge boat, a huge vessel taking people away from God. But in the last century, people have got on smaller boats to move away from the big boat. And what that is what I'd call postmodernism. Over the sort of period from the Enlightenment right up to about the end of the Second World War, the culture of the West was hugely shaped by what we might call modernism, which is basically saying, look, we've reasoned about how to make agriculture work. We've reasoned how to make factories work. We know how to make toasters work. We know how to make everything work. We even know how to make the human body work, basically. You know, we can heal tuberculosis. We can heal cholera. We can prevent epidemics. We know how to make public health. We know how to make sewage systems. We know how to educate the young better than we used to. We're much better at everything than we ever used to be. Everything. And because of that, we know also how to make society work perfectly in every sense. And great kind of all-encompassing systems of thought began to kind of stalk the land in a way that effectively kind of controlled whole countries, whole races, whole societies. And the examples are really obvious. Things like imperialism, the British Empire, set to dominate the world with its system of, you know, Latin hygiene and Christianity, pretty much in that order. We will control the world through that system. More obviously modernistic would be systems like communism, fascism, Nazism, socialism, various kinds of isms that present the way, the big story that makes sense of all of history. That if everyone would just jolly well get involved in it, it would make everything work better. Because it's obviously true. The true way to understand the world, if you're a communist, is that there's great economic forces that have shaped the way that, that people groups have developed, and that it's all working towards the final climax when the proletariat, the workers, will control the means of production, and we will live in a perfect paradise forever. That's the way history is going. That is the way it's going. Unavoidably, it's going there. It's going there, and that's the story of the world. That idea was so influential, it took on half the world's population. You know, Russia, China, and swathes of Eastern Europe and Cuba and other parts of the world came under the control of a system of thinking that was rooted in secular humanism. Ruthlessly anti-God, ruthlessly anti-revelation. Human reason elevated to the point where we can control everything, everybody, for their own good, obviously for their own good, for their good. Now, at the same time, you've got the right-wing examples of it, fascism, Nazism, Hitler, Mussolini, and so on. Similar ideas, really, at the end of the day, very similar ideas. Society can be controlled by modernist systems that are perfectly, you know, suited for every kind of person individualistically. Now, that was the going idea that kind of shaped society for a long time. But, of course, what we found out to our dismay in the first half of the 20th century was it was complete rubbish. It was a total disaster because you had immediately, I mean, the symbol of the 20th century was the Titanic. This great vessel, this great ship that was the perfect thing that even God couldn't sink it. You know, the arrogance of human reason. God can't sink, that's what they said. God couldn't sink this ship. Science, everything, all put together to make this perfect vessel that we cruise on to show how much we've arrived. We can just sit around having cocktails and enjoying the world that we've made for ourselves as Western man. And one iceberg takes it out. And that was the way I see it. That was like the 9/11 of its generation. It was like one event that affected the whole of a culture, whole of a generation. Because immediately after that, you've got the First World War, you've got the Great Depression, you've got the Second World War, you've got the genocide in Eastern Europe and all over the world, you've got the Holocaust against the Jews and other people groups, and then you've got apartheid gathering pace in South Africa. These huge systems, and then science, which has done us so many favors, helps us to generate bombs which take out entire cities in one go in Japan. Just one bomb takes out a quarter of a million people. And so all that modernity and modernism has done for us is really wreak a terrible harvest. Just we found actually all that we can do in our great systems is destroy life more efficiently. We used to kill each other, now we just kill more people. We're better at it. We're more efficient. There's more zeros on the end. Now, and just to add to it, just to add a kind of kick in the teeth, you have all these destructive wars and so on, but then also all of our civilization and science creates terrible effects on the environment. So it seems that global warming gets worse and worse and we cause pollution and so on and so forth. So our great multinational companies seem to have no conscience about the way they treat the environment and so on. So what's happened since then, especially in areas that influence those people like you, influence artists, those who shape culture, those who are creative types, is really a reaction against modernism. It's no more committed to, it's not a reaction, it's not swinging back to God. It's just swinging away from a big picture story of things. It's the idea that anybody who thinks that they can understand the whole world and squeeze it into one system is on a power trip. And they are dangerous. Because that's exactly what we suffered from. We suffered for too long. People who thought they could squeeze the world into a system, and you can't do it. The world is not like that. We react. We go our individual ways. We're all different people. We have our own individual story. We're all consumers of our own perfect product that we want to shape our destiny and our story. We live ultimately for ourselves and our own story, not for a flag, not for a great big story, not for the story of the empire or the Third Reich or the motherland or Chairman Mao. No, we live for ourselves, our own personal image, our own personal story. And that's postmodernism in a nutshell. And there's many other features of it we could go into. Now, I'm going to stop there because that is really going to go well over time if I go further. But you get the general idea from what I've said there. Why don't you have a quick break And then when we get together, I will just throw out a few questions which you can go away and discuss in your groups that Tim's going to organise in a moment. So we'll just have a quick break from minutes.